I'm David Guzik, and this is part two of a series where we're talking about how to study the Bible, especially how to study the Bible in preparation for teaching or preaching. And really what I'm doing is I'm just walking you step by step through the way that I prepare for a text and to teach on a passage of the Bible. Not that I would expect that you would do your preparation exactly in the same way I would do mine, but I'm just thinking sometimes people want to know what I do, and so I just thought I'd walk through it step by step what I do. Now, in the first video in this series, we gave 5 points, 5 steps. The first one was to begin with the text of the scripture. And we're using Psalm 28 as our example here. So what we do is we just read through Psalm 28 again and again, maybe in a few different Bible translations, just to get the sense of what is this saying? What's the flow? What are the big ideas? Where's the repetition? Where's the emphasis? We read it carefully, we read it deliberately. This is before we start writing anything out. We're just becoming familiar with the text itself, and as familiar as we can be. Secondly, we begin to organize big. And what I mean by that is we look for the major divisions in the chapter or in the psalm in this particular case. So if we're taking a look at this chapter, I divided it into 2 places. Verses 1 through 5 were part A, and then verses 6 through 9 were part B. That was the big organizational work, looking for the bigger themes and such. Then we move on to organizing the smaller areas of going down and breaking down the verses within the major sections. So we found 2 divisions within each one of those parts. So we had A and then 1 and 2 under that, dividing the verses. Then we had B, and it happened to work out 1 and 2 among that. Now, that's just the way that the psalm laid out. If it required 1, 2, 3, 4, we would have done it. If it required 3 different headings or 4 different headings, you just kind of try to let it work in itself and let it suggest its own organization instead of imposing an organization upon it. All right, that was the 3rd step, organize small. Then my 4th step is I give a title to the chapter or the psalm. And again, I may change the title before I'm done with it, but I just kind of want to get, what's this whole thing about in the big picture? Now that I've kind of read it many times, I've thought about it carefully, I've organized it at least in a skeleton way, then what would I title this chapter? How would I summarize it? And then finally, the 5th step, which in many ways is the most work, I go through it line by line, not necessarily feeling that I have to comment on every line, but just the things that I think are important. And so things that are very important, I might make several comments on the same sentence or word or set of words, or I may skip over things. Again, I'm not looking for some kind of legalistic way. You got to say something about every single verse and every single line within the verse. I'm just saying, okay, what does it speak? How am I understanding this? And I go through it. And again, all through steps 2, 3, 4, and 5, I'm writing. I'm typing out on my keyboard. I'm taking careful notes. Because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, in the description of a man named Pastor Nate Holdridge, Calvary Monterey, he described it this way: you read yourself full and then you write yourself empty. Again, I'm reading myself full of the scriptures and then I'm thinking, processing, line by line, going through that. We discussed all of that in some detail in the first part. Now we come to step 6. Step 6 is the commentary work. Now, many times people want to jump to the commentary work first. They don't want to spend the careful time of going through the text themselves. Now, look, I know a lot of Bible teachers, a lot of pastors that they don't have the privilege of having that be their full-time employment. They work a hard 8-hour, 10-hour, 12-hour day, and then they got to prepare for a preaching on Sunday or a midweek Bible study. Listen, there might be times and places where you got to go to the commentary sooner than you would like to. But if you have the time, if you can gain the energy, it should be your desire, your practice, to spend lots of time with the text yourself, training yourself how to understand and analyze the text. Then you go to the commentary work. Now, after I do my line-by-line thinking through the text, then it's time to hit the commentaries. My own time with the Lord, hopefully the Holy Spirit speaking to me in and through the Bible text. But after that's done, then I hit the commentaries. Again, it's important that I do the line by line thing first But I would also say that for me, as I have time, maybe for some reason I don't have the time to do it, but for the most part, it's important for me to see what other people have to say about the text. You see, there are many different reasons why I might use Bible commentaries. First of all, I want to see if my observations about the text were on target. I want to know if other people saw the same things. Because look, if I'm seeing something from the Bible text that nobody else has ever seen, that should raise some suspicion. Let me take a step back and really make sure that I'm seeing this. I need to want to make sure that my observations are on target and that other people see the same things. Now, if none of the books I read or places I go see the same thing, I'm not going to automatically say that what I observed was wrong. I'm going to suspect it for sure. But I'm going to go back to the text again and say, is this correct according to the text? So that's number one, to see if my observations about the text were on target. Number two, to see if there are things from the ancient languages, ancient culture, or ancient history that might help my understanding of the text. Oh, how many times a good commentary has been helpful for this. There's something in the language, the Greek or the Hebrew. There's something in the culture or a historical process or something that helps me understand the text so much better if I only knew it. I don't know it, but the commentator knows it. He's done more research than I have. That can be a big help. Number three, I want to know if there is significant disagreement with my take on the text as compared to the commentators. Let's say that I see something in the text, I'm approaching it a certain way, and other commentators say, whoa, they actually say something quite the opposite. Now, again, it doesn't mean that I'm automatically wrong. You know, look, this is what something I tell people about Bible commentary. Don't you lay down in front of a Bible commentator. What I mean by this is, and I say this as somebody who writes Bible commentary, if you understand the text in a certain way, and the Bible commentator you're reading understands it in an opposite way or in a different way, a markedly different way, don't automatically think that they're right and you're wrong. Now, maybe you're wrong, but what it should lead you to do is you go back to the text. Does that Bible commentator build his argument from the biblical text and a good understanding of the whole counsel of God, rightly dividing the word of truth? Do you build your understanding of the text based on the whole counsel of God and a right dividing of the text? So this is what you need to do. You don't automatically think, well, if it's in a book, they're right and I'm wrong. No, not at all. But it makes you go back to the text and say, let's sort it out according to what the Bible teaches. That's a third reason. A fourth reason is, I want to see if the commentators make some helpful biblical connections that I missed. For example, we saw that in our text, Psalm 28, we saw this verse, verse 5, where he says, they do not regard the works of the Lord. And for me, that triggered a connection with Romans chapter 1, verses 20 and 21. Well, if it didn't trigger that connection, maybe reading a commentator that points it out makes it, yes, there's a connection here with another passage of scripture that I never saw, and that can be helpful. And then fifthly, I want to see that if that commentator uses some memorable words, phrases, descriptions, or illustrations that are helpful for me. There's many times when I've been reading a commentary or listening to a sermon, I go, they see what I see in the text, but man, the way they said it, that is helpful. I'm going to quote them. I'm going to refer back to them in that. So those are reasons to use the Bible commentaries. Now, as for my study through the Psalms, here's a list of the Bible commentaries that I read for Psalms, for Psalm 28 specifically. First of all, I used Alexander McLaren. I used his work in the Expositor's Bible, volumes 1, 2, and 3. McLaren was an independent, what some people call a nonconformist British preacher from the late 19th and early 20th century. His sermons are very helpful, and in the Expositor's Bible, he gives an exposition, kind of a preacher-like exposition, of each particular psalm. So I use the Expositor's Bible, Alexander McLaren's work on the Psalms in that. Secondly, I used James Montgomery Boyce. His work, Psalms and Expositional Commentary, I think it's in three volumes. Boyce was a great Bible teacher and preacher in Philadelphia. He died in the year 2000. He was Presbyterian, often gives a Reformed perspective, sometimes more Reformed than I am in my own theology. But listen, the guy's a good expositor. You can learn a lot from James Montgomery Boyce. Next, I would use G. Campbell Morgan. G. Campbell Morgan was a British pastor and a skilled expositor. He pastored in London in the first half of the 20th century. And I actually use a couple different books by G. Campbell Morgan. One of them is called An Exposition of the Whole Bible. I think I have one back here. This is the book, An Exposition of the Whole Bible. In this book, An Exposition of the Whole Bible, sorry, my dust cover on it is completely torn, but this is the book. He gives a few paragraphs on every chapter in the Bible. It's a very helpful book. For the Psalms, the same content is included in his book, Notes on the Psalms, but he just gives a few paragraph summary of every chapter in the Bible, including Psalms, of course. Then he has another book that I find to be very helpful called Searchlights from the Word. There he gives a devotional thought on one verse from every chapter in the Bible. Lots of good nuggets in Searchlights from the Word. Okay, beyond G. Campbell Morgan, I also use a guy named F.B. Meyer. F.B. Meyer was an independent Baptist pastor and evangelist in England in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. I like to use his book titled Our Daily Homily, which is very much like G. Campbell Morgan's Searchlights from the Word. It's a devotional thought on one verse from every chapter in the Bible. Now look, this is just one paragraph. It's not going to take long to read, but there's a lot of good nuggets in there. I'm also using, as I make my way through Psalms, I use Matthew Poole. Matthew Poole was an English Baptist writer and theologian in the 1600s. His commentary on the Holy Bible is something that I often use. Matthew Poole, with an E at the end. I've also appreciated the work of Willem van Gemeren. He wrote the section on Psalms in the Expositor's Bible Commentary. That's a Bible commentary set that was first published in 1991. It's a good commentary on Psalms from a little more of an academic standpoint than some of the other commentaries I'm using. John Trapp was an English Anglican pastor and Bible commentator in the 1600s. His commentary on the Old and New Testament is something I often use. Back here, here's John Trapp. His work on the Old and New Testament. Here's volume 2, Ezra to Psalms. I'm also making, as I make my way through Psalms, use of a guy named George Horn. Here's commentary on Psalms. Horn was an Anglican bishop in the 1700s. Funny looking guy, isn't he? Anyway, George Horn, Anglican bishop in the 1700s. Interesting. One of my favorite commentators is a guy I'm using through Psalms, Derek Kidner. Kidner was a British scholar and an Anglican pastor. He wrote several Old Testament commentaries. His work on Psalms in the Tyndale Old Testament Commentary series, it is excellent. Derek Kidner, one of my favorite commentators, actually, in the Old Testament. Then I also use Adam Clark, Clark with an E at the end. Clark was an English Methodist theologian. Here's his volume 3 in his set. And a Bible scholar in the late 18th and early 19th century. His commentary is interesting. Now, many of these commentaries you can find in electronic form in different versions. If you're going to use Adam Clark, I recommend using his unabridged version. I've read Clark in both the normal, the full version, and the abridged version. The unabridged, the full version, is much better, in my opinion. Then we have Charles Spurgeon. Spurgeon was the great Baptist preacher of Victorian England in the late 19th century. Now, I use two main works of Spurgeon in my study of the Psalms. The first one is The Treasury of David. The Treasury of David was Charles Spurgeon's epic commentary on the Book of Psalms. It's a detailed commentary on every psalm. Again, it's an outstanding work. The Treasury of David. Take you a long time to read through it. When I went through Psalms, I read every page of the Treasury of David. And then also Spurgeon's sermons. Now, they're collected in two sets. The first one is just a few volumes called the New Park Street Pulpit. but then the Metropolitan Tabernacle Pulpit, collectively something like 63, 65 volumes. And they're a treasure of sermons for their often expository character. My judgment of Spurgeon, he's a favorite of mine. I would say that maybe a third of his sermons, maybe two-thirds of his sermons, somewhere between there, were brilliant expositions of the text. Some of them, he just used the text as a launching point to preach a sermon, which has its place. But many, if not most, of Spurgeon's sermons, brilliant expositions of the text. Basically, what I would do is I would just go through and look at what Spurgeon preached on Psalm 28, and I would read it, okay, or whatever passage I'm on. So that's what I would do. Okay, now, how do I use these Bible commentaries? Well, in working through these commentaries, I'm reading very closely some of them, and others of them I scan. You see, pretty early on, I learn the commentaries I'll scan because maybe they're not as helpful, and the commentaries that are more helpful, and I'll scan those more closely. Now, you might be saying, David, look, this is actually, I used a few more commentaries than I've listed right here, but you might say, David, are you seriously reading all of these Bible commentaries? Well, yeah, I mean, I do. I like to use, if I'm going through a book of the Bible, 8, 10, 12 commentaries if I can. And I know it takes time, it takes work, but that's how I like to do my work. If you can only use 3 or 4, well, then be selective about the 3 or 4. If you're limited for time, don't waste your time on unhelpful commentaries. Sort through 7 or 8 of them and get the ones that are helpful and go with them. But anyway, some of those commentaries I'm reading very closely, other ones I'm scanning. And as I read, I take notes from each commentary. And what I do is when they say something of note, either as a quote or just a thought, I jot it down. I type it into my computer. So I'm going to show you through each one of these commentaries what I read in there and thought was worthy of note. So I'm going to have a black text. That's the what I take over from the commentary, a quote usually. The blue text, I'm trying to explain just a little bit as to why I thought that particular comment was worthy of notice. So here we go, Psalm 28. These are my notes as I read through the commentary. From G. Campbell Morgan, quote, "It's a remarkable fact that in all the Old Testament literature, rock is reserved as a figure of deity, never for man." By the way, it just makes me think, what is it? That's actor Dwayne the Rock Johnson? That's not biblical. The Bible only calls the Lord the rock, never a man. Now, that's the kind of statement that catches my eye. Something says that this passage has something unique or special about it. I go, yeah, this is wonderful. It just catches my eye, that statement. Then a second thing I quote from Morgan is, quote, "Suddenly, the prayer becomes a song of praise, an act of adoration." Now, look, I had the same idea when I read through the text, but I like how he phrased that. That's a great phrase. The prayer becomes a song of praise, an act of adoration. Morgan said it very well. So same idea. I had the same thought, but he wrote it very well. Okay, now, F.B. Meyer. Here's what I got from his, he's just writing a paragraph or two on his things, our daily homily. From a verse. And so this is what he's writing. He's saying, quote, "Whatever is dear to the loved one is dear to the lover. You cannot love the pastor without taking a keen interest in all that interests him, and especially in the sheep of his pasture and the people of his hand. Hence, when you are nearest the Lord, you are almost certain to begin pleading for his inheritance and saying, save thy people, bless them, feed them, and lift them up forever." Now, Meyer was just giving a very good devotional thought on the last verse of the psalm. I think that's a great observation. And then again, here's another quote from Meyer, quote, "Jesus does not simply lead us to green pastures and still waters. He bears us, and he bears us up, and he does so forever, never tiring, though he imparts infinite rest, never ceasing for a moment his shepherd care." You know what? That's just a great sentence. I like that. So I wrote it down. I don't know if I'm going to put it in my commentary or not, but I like it. Okay, now, going on to a next commentator, Derek Kidner. Kidner writes, I like this quote from him. "The situation is probably illness or deep despair, and the fear is not a dread of death as such, but of death with unmerited disgrace. I think that's a great observation. Echidna almost always has good things to say. And what I like is how he points out that David wasn't just afraid of dying, but dying what seemed to be, you could call it, a needless death, an unheroic death. David was ready to die, but if he was going to die, he wanted it to be a hero's death, not a seemingly worthless one. Another quote from Kidner. This need not mean that the psalm is later than David, only that the word had become the standard term for the ark's abode by Solomon's time, which suggests that it was in use well before this. Now, again, I had the same thought when I was going through it, but I love it when a commentator I respect, like Derek Kidner, agrees with me. So, yes, kind of saying, oh, good, I'm glad I got that. Another quote. Quote, even worse than consignment to the will of the wicked, which was the fear of Psalm 27:12, is consignment with them to the disgrace they have earned. Again, that's a great remark. The difference between consignment to and consignment with. In other words, not just being put to the wicked, but with the wicked. I like that. Then again, he quotes this on Psalm 28, verses 3 through 5. He says, these verses are not simply vindictive, but put into words the protest of any healthy conscience at the wrongs of the present order and the conviction that a day of judgment is a moral necessity. Again, I just really go, man, Kidner, that's what this psalm is saying. You know how to phrase it well. Another quote from Kidner. You can see I like this commentator. I'm quoting him a lot. Quote, the pictures of his saving power, both active, strength, shepherd, and defensive, shield, refuge, come in profusion now. Now, that's interesting because I hadn't thought of those images. Kidner's talking about something that kind of escaped me, how there's active pictures, strength and shepherd, and then there's defensive pictures, shield and refuge. I like that. That's an interesting view. I don't know if I'm going to put it in my notes, but it struck me. Next, Kidner says, there is a small textual difficulty in verse 8 where the Hebrew has of them, as it is in the King James, instead of as of his people through the apparent omission of one letter. Now, I find it interesting when commentators note textual issues, something in the manuscripts. This one really doesn't seem to make much of a difference. The New King James Version, which I do my expositions from, has note of that in the margin, and it translates it as their strength. So I don't know. I just put it in my notes. Maybe I'll include it in my teaching notes. Maybe I won't. Okay, on to next commentator, Alexander McLaren. Quote, Jehovah seems deaf when prayer is unanswered and is silent when he does not speak in deliverance. Again, I had the same thought, but I like that wording. It's memorable. Maybe I'll use it. McLaren also wrote this, quote, this is the blessing which every true suppliant may bear away from the throne, the peace which passes understanding, the sure pledge of the divine act which answers prayer. Now, McLaren is writing a verse 6. That's the confidence that David had that God had heard his prayer. Again, am I going to use it? Nah, maybe, maybe not, but it caught my eye. I just want you to know, I'm reading through McLaren, seeing what catches my mind or my thoughts, and then going on from there. Now, here's one from James Montgomery Boyce. Quote, if he is appealing to God not to remain silent, it must have been because God has been silent for a while. He has not been answering, and David is appealing to him to break his silence and to speak to him at last. Now, Boyce is making some good comments here on verse 1, which in his translation, he's teaching from the New International Version, the NIV. If you remain silent. Now, here's the deal. The New King James Version in verse 1 doesn't read remain silent. It reads be silent. Now, this is important because the point Boyce is making is not clear from the New King James Version, and that's what I'm teaching from. So, if I'm going to use Boyce's point in my teaching notes, I got to explain it. Maybe I will, maybe I won't, but it's interesting to me. Now, it's unusual that I don't quote more from Boyce on Psalm 28, because I often find it to be more helpful, but you know what? I'm not trying to force this. I'm not trying to say, well, I've got a quota of 4 quotes from James Montgomery Boyce that I want to put in this. No, not at all. If it speaks to me, it speaks to me. If not, well, then I'll move on. He's moving on to Matthew Poole. He said in verse 6, He speaks of it as past, either because God had in part heard and answered him directly, or because God assured him by his Spirit that he had heard and accepted his prayers and would assuredly answer him in due time. I just thought that was a clear explanation from Poole on the idea there in verse 6. Then we come to Willem van Gemeren. He says this, quote, "The deafness of God is an anthropomorphic expression. It is equivalent to the prayer, 'Do not hide your face from me,' in Psalm 27, verse 9. Now, that's a good point by van Gemeren on the idea of God not being silent in the first few verses. That's obvious. I mean, God isn't actually deaf, but we're using an anthropomorphism. It's obvious, but obviously not mentioned many times. Another quote from van Gemeren says this, "The acts of the Lord in creation, redemption, and Yahweh's rule through David reveal the wonder of God's purpose. The history of redemption condemns the wicked." I like that. That's a good thought on verse 5. "They do not regard the works of the Lord, nor the operation of his hands." Good. Okay, continuing on van Gemeren, I quote this sentence from him. He says, quote, "He cares for his sheep in a tender way, so as to carry them in his arms." The imagery is reminiscent of Isaiah's language. And then he's listing these verses from Isaiah and then Exodus. And of course, the words of our Lord from John chapter 10. I like that. That is a good point on the sweet ending verse of the psalm. This connection to other Bible passages that didn't come to mind for me. Nice to be reminded of it in this commentary. So you see, I did make a connection in verse 5 with Romans chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, but I didn't make a nice connection there in verse 9 with the idea of bearing them, carrying them in his arms. I like that. Good on you, van Gemeren, for that. Then we're to John Trapp. I quote this from his phrase, "Lift my hands," in the psalm. He says, quote, "An ordinary gesture in prayer expressing faith, for they held out their open hands as craving beggars." I like that line. I just like that sentence. It's a good reminder from Trapp on what it meant to lift up the hands for an ancient Hebrew like David. Then to Bishop Horn, his commentary. You know what? That Anglican bishop, I didn't find anything of note in Horn's comments. Sometimes I don't. Again, I'm not forcing myself to note something from every commentary that I read. Okay, continuing on, we're talking about Adam Clark, and what did I gain from his commentary? Well, Clark quotes this passage from "O Lord, My Rock." He's giving the Hebrew word suri, and not only means my rock, but my fountain and the origin of all the good I possess. Now, I never read that before. Kind of caught my eye. Maybe I'll use it, maybe not. And then he says, quote, "It is a modern refinement in theology which teaches that no man can know when God hears and answers his prayers. True religion knows nothing of these abominations. It teaches its votaries to pray to God, to expect answer from him, and to look for the Holy Spirit to bear witness with their spirits that they are the sons and daughters of God." I just thought that was a nice thought on David's confidence that the Lord must hear and did hear his prayer. Then he goes on, here's the line about lifting up his hands toward the holy sanctuary. Quote, "This is a presumptive proof that there was a temple now standing, and the custom of stretching out the hands in prayer toward the temple when the Jews were at distance from it is here referred to." Now, what he's saying is he doesn't believe that David wrote this psalm, that this psalm was written in later days when the temple was built. Now, I don't agree with Adam Clark on this point. Because if it were true, again, it would mean that David didn't write the psalm. But I think it's interesting, so I make note of it. Maybe I'll include it. I don't know. We'll see. Then we also have the phrase, continuing on, "shepherd them also." Again, Adam Clark likes to bring out significance from the Greek and the Hebrew. So here from the Hebrew, he's saying, "ra" signifies both to feed and to govern. Feed them as a shepherd does his flock, rule them as a father does his children. Now, Clark is here looking at verse 9, which especially in the King James wording of it says, "feed them also," instead of "shepherd them also" in the New King James. But it's a helpful reminder that a particular translation of the Bible influences what the commentator works from. Okay, continuing on in our commentators, you can see this is a lot of work, isn't it? Well, doing what I do and doing what we want to do as Bible teachers, it takes a lot of work. And sometimes we have to pare down on the number of Bible commentators that we use because we just don't have time, but we do what we can. Here's Charles Spurgeon from his Treasury of David. Quote, "Mere formalists may be content without answers to their prayers, but genuine supplicants cannot. They are not satisfied the results of prayer itself in calming the mind and subduing the will. They must go further and obtain the actual replies from heaven, or they cannot rest." Now, Spurgeon knows how to say things with power, doesn't he? And especially how to draw contrast. Here's the contrast between the true faith of David and the weak faith of the formalist. Spurgeon's trying to make the distinction between people that think that prayer is just a therapeutic exercise and those who think that prayer actually accomplishes something. Now, I believe prayer is good therapy, but it's more than that. And I like the way Spurgeon said that. Now he's talking about the phrase workers of iniquity. He says, "Activity is found with the wicked, even if it is lacking to the righteous. Oh, to be workers for the Lord." What a great thought from Charles Spurgeon on a simple phrase. Now, I wrote that line from Psalm 28 that he spoke out in bold just so that I would be sure of what he referred to. Isn't that marvelous? That phrase, workers of iniquity. Well, if people are going to be workers for iniquity, should we not be workers for the Lord? Great thought from Spurgeon. Okay, next quote. And again, these are just things that I compiled from the Treasury of David. He says, "Soft words, oily with pretended love, are the deceitful meshes of the infernal net which Satan catches the precious life. Many of his children are learned in this abominable craft and fish with their father's nets almost as cunningly as he himself could do it." Listen, that's an awesome thought on the phrase, "who speak peace to their neighbors, but evil is in their hearts." Man, I wish I could speak that good. Sometimes I wish that I could write one sentence as powerfully as Charles Spurgeon did. Just beautiful. Next quote from Spurgeon that I made note of. This is from verse 5. It said, "God works in creation. Nature teems with proofs of his wisdom and goodness. Yet pure blind atheists refuse to see him. He works in providence, ruling and overruling his hand is very manifest in human history, yet the infidel will not discern him. He works in grace. Remarkable conversions are still met with on all hands, yet the ungodly refuse to see the operations of the Lord." It's a great thought on verse 5. Now continuing on, here's another quote from Spurgeon's Treasury of David. He says, "Real praise is established upon sufficient and constraining reasons. It is not irrational emotion, but rises like a pure spring from the deeps of experience." Here he's speaking about the phrase, "because he heard the voice of my supplications." That's in verse 6. Great thought there. Now, in his Treasury of David, not only does Spurgeon have his own expository thoughts on each verse, but he also has collected thoughts from other writers. Now, often when I go through those thoughts from other writers, I find something in there to remark upon. But in Psalm 28, I didn't. If I did, I would put it in my notes like this: Jones cited in Spurgeon. And I myself would know that it came from the Treasury of David. Now, Spurgeon also preached a few sermons from Psalm 28, and I read those as well. One sermon was titled, "Safe Though Sin Surrounded," and he preached that on Psalm 28, verse 1, and it's sermon number 3535 in Spurgeon's index. Now again, some of Spurgeon's sermons are great expositions, and in others, he uses the text more as a launching pad. That sermon was more of a launching point, and I didn't find a whole lot in that sermon that was helpful in explaining the passage itself. In that sermon, he took the cue from a French preacher named Massillon, who approached the psalm from the perspective that David was tempted and tried with his associations with the ungodly, and prayed this psalm to be preserved from trials connected with those associations. Now, I put that in my own notes just so that I would know and remember that, but I can tell that that's my own explanation. It's not a quote from Spurgeon. There's no quotation marks around it, and the paragraph isn't indented. Now, here's my quote from Spurgeon's sermon that I might use in it. He says this, quote, again, he's speaking about verse 1. Quote, "I have been inclined lately when I've read the papers to interpret the term scum of society, to refer to those who float on the top. For certainly there is no rank of society that could have figured more abominably in the divorce court, no rank of society that could have exhibited itself so detestably upon the race course than the peerage of this realm. And unless God mend the manners of the right honorables, their names will have to be right abominables. The term will be more suitable to them by far. Man, I don't know if I'm going to use that quote, but it is a memorable quote by Spurgeon. I like that one. I should tweet that quote. That's a great idea. Okay, here's another sermon that he preached on Psalm 28. It's from Psalm 28, verse 7, and it's titled A Sacred Solo. That sermon, in my estimation, was more helpful in explaining the text. So I found a few more helpful insights from that message. So here's a few quotes from Spurgeon's sermon titled A Sacred Solo on Psalm 28, verse 7. He says this, quote, "My dear friend, if you can say, the Lord is my strength, then you can bear anything and everything. You could bear a martyr's death if the Lord should be your strength. He could make a stalk of wheat to bear up the whole world if he strengthened it." Man, that's a great thought. What memorable phrasing. Okay, here's another quote. Quote, "Where would you hide yourself, said one to Luther, if the Elector of Saxony should withdraw his protection? He smiled and said, I put no trust in the Prince of Saxony. Beneath the broad shield of heaven, I stand secure against Pope and Turk and devil. He did, and so do we." End quote. Man, I love it when Spurgeon quotes things from history, and he loves to tell brief little stories from the life of Martin Luther and other people. Continuing on, here's another quote from Spurgeon from Psalm 28, verse 7. He says, "To my mind, there's hardly anything more sad than the frequent laughter which exposes a vacant mind." Well, that's powerful. The frequent laughter which exposes a vacant mind? Man, that's powerful. All right, there's one other sermon that Spurgeon preached from Psalm 28. It's from verse 9, and he titled it A Prayer for the Church Militant. That's sermon number 768 in Spurgeon's index. And in my view, that text was used, again, pretty much as a launching point, so I didn't find anything that would be really helpful in the notes. Though, to be honest, listen, I might be suffering from a little bit of study fatigue at this point. Do you know what I mean by study fatigue? I've been reading a lot of commentaries. I've spent my own time examining the text. If I'm just sitting in a chair doing, we're probably up at 5, 6, 7 hours of study at least at this point. I'm getting a little tired of reading as much the same thing. Maybe if I would have read this sermon at the beginning of my study, I would have got more out of it. But you know what? That's how it goes. And I order the reading of the commentaries that I use in that, with that in mind. So I really didn't have anything that I included from my notes from that particular sermon that Spurgeon preached. Okay, what do I do? I've done reading all my commentaries. I'm done taking the notes that I take on my commentaries. So what do I do next? Well, this is point 7. After my commentary work, which was number 6, then point 7, I bring the commentary work into my notes.